Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. So there's a phrase that comes up when we talk about acts of terror, senseless violence, which implies that there can be no comprehensible reason, no sane rationale for shooting up a nightclub or loading a truck with explosives. But terrorism experts tell us that that's not actually true. There are real compelling reasons and motivations, some of which we share, which can drive ordinary people to commit extreme acts of violence.
I think the closest I ever came to traveling overseas to fight was one time I was in the mosque with a few of my friends. Two of them, they were asked right on the spot, do you want to go to Yemen? And they said, sure. And that was the last I saw of them, heard of them, heard from them. Don't know what happened. Just disappeared. I was ready to go, but I hadn't done enough of the prep work, so to speak. My name is Mubeen Sheikh. I'm a former extremist turned government-level counterterrorism expert.
One of the biggest misconceptions about terrorists is that they're nothing like us. They don't have the same feelings, values, ideals. They've somehow parted company from the human race. Well, today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're going to show you that that's not the case. We're going to ask you to imagine an extremist who is maybe not that different from the guy next door, someone like Mubeen Sheikh.
I was born in a time where there was one mosque in all of Toronto. I come from a religious family. We would go to the mosque at least once a day. So it was me going to public school by daytime and going to Quran school by evening time, and basically setting the stage for what I like to think of as an identity crisis that would manifest acutely later on in my life. So I was 17 and my parents were in India. And I decided, hey, the family's gone. Let me have a party. And, that evening, those people just started showing up, as expected, of course. There was easily 100 people there, easily. And I'm standing on the veranda with a friend of mine, and he says, hey, who's that? And I look over, and I can see the outline of an adult male with a bright white hat and a bright white robe. And I realized, oh boy, this is my uncle. And I'll be honest, I almost pissed my pants. And my uncle just walked up to me and slapped me in the face. And then suddenly he just bellowed really loudly, you know, get out, all of you. And, oh, man, you could hear the stampede of people running out. They literally ran out. He, of course, had me in a grip. And that's when he said, you know, he goes, you know, people pray in this house, you know. People read Quran in this house. You know, what have you done? You know, what have you done? And it was just a feeling of absolute guilt and shame that just overcame me. I just wanted to not be in existence at that moment and realized, okay, the only way that I can fix this is for me to get religious, quote unquote. And getting religious, quote unquote, in my context was a group called the Tablighi Jamaat. Now, the Tablighi Jamaat is an apolitical, religiously conservative group that proselytizes to other Muslims. So basically, they convince Muslims to be more observant. And so one of the things that they have is a program, if you will, of 4 months. And the way that they had set it up was you would do 2 months in India, 2 months in Pakistan. And in May of 1995, got on a plane and flew to India. The Tablighi Jamaat, they do have a headquarters, if you will, in Delhi, and you live in the mosque. You eat there, you sleep there, and your daily activities would be, you know, you would go around the local area, talk to the people, how are you? This Jamaat has come from Canada, please come to the mosque, we have some lectures, things like that. After spending 2 months in India, I was then sent to Pakistan, and in Pakistan, I was sent to a city called Quetta. Quetta was the stronghold of the Taliban and it still is. And so just like I did in India, I would walk around the local area to see, you know, what's going on and who's there and who I could talk to and basically invite them to the mosque. And as I was walking around, I could see some guys, they had turbans, beards, robes. So I thought, oh, these are, you know, other religious guys that let me go and talk to them. So as I came close to them, I saw that, in fact, they were armed. They had rocket-propelled grenades, AK-47s, other weapons, ammunition. And I quickly realized these guys aren't religious guys. They're something else. I didn't know what else and who they were. And so I basically gave them the same talk that I would give everyone else, right, to bring about change in the world. You do this and you do that. And they listened to me. And the one guy actually said, look, if you really want to change the world, you do it with this. And he held up his AK-47. And he says, you know, by jihad is how you change things. It's how you change the world. You know, they had this swashbuckling, you know, way about them. It was almost like the manifestation of the ancient heroes of the Muslim world. And I became completely enamored by them and bit by the so-called jihadi bug. So I returned to Toronto, Canada, of course, in September 1995. And I was thinking about what they had said. It really appealed to me. And as I began to think about it more, I started to become bored with the Tablighi Jamaat. And so that's when I realized, okay, this is not for me. And I knew of a mosque nearby, actually, where there were guys who were a little more open about their political views or about politics in general. But this was less about politics, per se, and more so about the idea of this jihadist identity. For you to self-identify as a jihadi or as a mujahid, somebody who is a combatant, this is really what it came down to. So in 1998, Osama bin Laden came out with his fatwa. And of course, the bombings that took place thereafter in Tanzania. And so that was our religion, if you will. This very militant worldview, clearly defined enemies, we're God's elect. You know, we're doing what other Muslims are too cowardly to do or too ignorant to do on a religious level. And this is how we saw ourselves. In terms of the anger that manifested in my life, I think my anger, even at that time, came from childhood sexual abuse with the family relative, actually. And even to this day, I mean, I'm 40 years old now. There are entire blocks of my childhood which I just don't remember. You know, I remember knowing that I was angry. After that, I did confront him. Actually, I threatened to break his back when I was, you know, I was much older and bigger and stronger. But I knew if I killed him, everyone would know that I did it. So he's still alive. You know, I got over it, I think. So 2001. The September 11 attacks happened. That prompts me to reconsider my worldview and decide, look, I don't know my religion properly. I don't know Arabic. I hadn't studied it in any formal way. So I decided I was going to move to Syria. And so in 2002, I moved to Syria, early 2002. I go to an Islamic university and I meet this scholar. And his nickname was Sheikh Al-Bahar. Al-Bahar means like the ocean. And they called him this because his knowledge was like the ocean. And basically, I mean, the first day that we met, I gave my name. And I had named my oldest son Mujahid, which is one who does jihad. And so he called me on it, basically saying, what, are you a jihadi? And I said, yeah, I am. And he goes, what does jihad mean? And I said, oh, it means fighting. And he goes, that's not what jihad means. And so that was his approach. So we spoke after class, and then I would then study with him Tuesdays and Thursdays. And if what he did was effectively, he debunked my extremist interpretations, you know, verse by verse by verse, looking at the history of Islam, all the things that happened because one of the main problems of extremist Muslims is that they have a very romanticized view of history. They think, you know, under Sharia and caliphate, we all lived happily ever after, right? And that was never the case. So that systematic debunking is really what sealed the de-radicalization process for me. You know, a former white supremacist friend of mine, Arnold Michaelis, he's a Buddhist now. And he says, hurt people, hurt people. If you come from a broken background, the likelihood of you becoming a bad person is greater than if you don't come from a broken background. So then when somebody like that looks at a jihadi video with a guy getting his head cut off or shot in the back of the head or whatever, that's nothing. That's actually something good. Like you get satiated by looking at that level of violence. So these are the kinds of things that can push people into extremism.
Mubin Sheikh is a former extremist who became a counterterrorism expert. If you want to read more about his journey, check out his memoir, Undercover Jihadi. Raymond Tangakar produced our story. So Mubin comes across as a reasonable guy, don't you think? The kind of person you might want to hang out with, grab a coffee with. Well, psychologist Clark McCauley has been studying terrorist groups and lone actor extremists for years. And one thing he's discovered is that most of them are not monsters. In fact, they share many of the same values and motivations as the rest of us. Because a lot of the time, it's not ideology that compels people to commit terrorist acts. It's social bonds.
Most of us belong to many groups. But when your whole social world contracts down to just one particular group, an underground cell of some kind, then the power of that group to set norms and determine morality is just unlimited. You get to see that same kind of horsepower with small groups in combat.
But you're not suggesting that there is something similar with terrorists, really?
That I you am could suggesting compare... that. The group dynamics of an intense small group in combat is very similar to the group dynamics of an intense small terrorist cell. Both of them are cut off from all other kinds of social influence, and both of them are completely dependent on their survival, for their survival, on these few people around them.
Hmm. Usually the way we tell those stories, it's about the process of radicalization. So you get, you know, young people who've come under the influence of maybe a powerful leader. It seems like more of an authority power structure and power dynamic to me than a small band of brothers. I don't know, is there a difference there?
Well, it is true that a lot of people talk just the way you were mentioning, that basically the problem is some charismatic and probably evil person who influences young and impressionable people. But actually, there's very little of that. It's people looking for a way to express their concern about victimization, as they see it, of people that they care about. So an amazing amount of it is bottom-up as opposed to top-down, and we can't really understand the problem if we're going to insist on talking about it as a top-down, charismatic influence problem.
Hmm. Now, you also said you weren't crazy about thinking of it in terms of psychopathology, but I mean, surely there's some degree of delusional thinking or obsession or irrationality?
No, very seldom amongst the people who are members of a group. But there is one exception. Mm-hmm. So there is at least one profile of lone actor terrorist, which does involve some psychopathology. This is a profile that Sofia Moskalenko and I have called disordered disconnected. These are people who tend to be loners, or they've recently lost their social connections. They have some history of mental disorder, especially depression, and they have a grievance. And what that amounts to is if you're suffering from some grievance as you see it, and if you are suffering from some kind of psychopathology, that means you're not a happy person, you don't have very much to lose in acting on your grievance.
But you said there's another kind of lone wolf terrorist. There are two categories?
Yes. The other profile that we have suggested is a caring, compelled profile. There are examples of lone actor terrorists who have no history of mental disorder, who have good social connections, family and friends and work, but who seem to be capable of more intense sympathy and empathy than most of us. And they feel so strongly their emotional reaction to the suffering of others as they see it, the people they see being victimized, their reaction is so strong that they just feel like they have got to do something. Now, this is a little hard for most people to get hold of, I admit, because it amounts to saying that there's a potential dark side to qualities that we usually think of as quintessentially human and mm-hmm. humane. But we're suggesting there are some people who feel so strongly that they just can't help. They have to do something. So, Momin Khawaja, a Canadian-Pakistani terrorist who was convicted of complicity in a bomb plot in the UK. He's this kind of a person. He's smart. He's hardworking. He's got great social connections. He had a good job. So he's one of these examples of somebody who doesn't fit the disconnected disordered. We think he fits the caring compelled. He just is the kind of person who feels super strong about the suffering of others.
Tell me more about him, because this is a case that I'm not that familiar with. And as you said, there is something just so startling about the idea that something as fundamentally inhumane as terrorism could come out of some of our most human emotions, sympathy and compassion. So how do you see that playing out in Momin Khawaja's story?
Well, he lived in a Muslim subculture and community in Ottawa, where pretty much everybody agreed that the Palestinians were victimized by the Israelis, that the invasion of Afghanistan was a victimization of Muslims in Afghanistan. And he is a Muslim, and he watched videos of the sufferings of these people. Now, if you're the kind of person who feels deeply and you watch these kinds of videos, then you're going to feel this powerful urge. These people are suffering. It's outrageous. I've got to do something.
But how come Momin's capacity for sympathy and empathy didn't lead him to look sympathetically or empathetically at his potential victims?
Well, because he's focused on the victims that he cares about. You could say that there's something similar goes on in the U.S. when we have reported collateral damage that's done by U.S. attacks in mostly these days in Muslim countries. So why is it that we aren't more concerned? Well, it has to do with who you care most about. It has to do with who you love.
You know, the funny thing is you're making terrorists sound like normal people.
That's what I've been trying to argue for 10 years now. They're not psychopathology. They're not evil. They're people like you and me who have been put in situations we should hope we never are put in.
Would you go so far as to say none of us is immune to that kind of transformation?
Well, there may be a few psychopaths, selfish people who are immune, but yes, the great majority of us and normal people, we are susceptible to it, because at the bottom, you see, it's not hate that's at the bottom of intergroup violence. It's love. It's love for the in-group. Anybody who really loves is capable of anger and outrage when the people they see that they love are being victimized, harmed, unjustly hurt. It's, I would say, almost the default.
So it sounds like these are crimes that begin with enormous sympathy and empathy for, you know, a victimized population, and the ideology sort of comes later. The agenda for how we do something about it is secondary.
I think that's right, but we got to be a little careful about what we mean by ideology. I mean, I think a great deal of intergroup violence is as simple as they did it to us. They're not going to get away with it. We're going to do it back to them so they can see what it's like. Now, I don't call that ideology. I call that something like the reciprocity rule. Mm-hmm. I mean, human beings, and these are normal human beings we're talking about, I keep insisting. Normal human beings don't kill other normal human beings without having some story to tell to themselves and to tell to others as to why they're doing it. And I think a lot of people turn from they can't get away with it to, oh, yes, and here's a more complex rationale that comes to the same conclusion, that they can't get away with it and we're going to have to deal with these people and so on and so forth. We're saving our society or our culture or whatever. So, yes, we do get to see ideology in almost every extended intergroup conflict, especially if it involves violence. But from what I can see, and my own opinion is, it's more often rationalization than it is a cause.
Clark McCauley is a psychologist and the co-author of Friction, How Radicalization Happens to Them and Us. Coming up, the story behind one of the worst attacks in Norway's history, insight into the mind of Anders Breivik. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In some ways, the terrorists who are the hardest to understand are the lone wolves, precisely because nobody knows them very well. They're alienated. They don't have a lot of friends. The neighbors never see them. And then suddenly, who knows why, one of them shoots up a nightclub or a peaceful rally or a school or a summer camp. In 2011, 69 teenagers were shot and killed at a Norwegian summer youth camp. It was one of the worst mass murders in modern history and a national trauma in Norway. The gunman was a white supremacist neo-Nazi named Anders Breivik. Journalist Asna Sejersted covered his trial, and then she spent several years trying to figure out how someone who seemed relatively normal could do something so evil. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with Asna about her book, One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway.
He was born like one of us, typical in many senses. And then at some point, he decides to go against all of us. It would be too easy to say, you know, he is ill, he's sick, he's mean, he's evil, he's not one of us. When you go through his life, you see that he's actually quite normal. It's normalcy that strikes you.
Hmm. So even though he committed this horrible atrocity, I mean, you know, killing 77 people, you do not use the word evil to describe him.
Oh, his actions are definitely evil. And I think, yes, he's evil. I think you could say that about him. But none of us are born evil. That does not exist. When does he become a terrorist? When does he become evil? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, we should just briefly sketch the outlines of his early life. I mean, as you say, he had a pretty miserable childhood. I mean, his father basically abandoned him when he was very little. He grew up with an unstable mother, I mean, probably mentally ill, never really fit in, and was wanted to fit in, but just couldn't for whatever reason, and just seemed to become an extreme loner.
Yeah, and there's so many, how to say, unlucky combinations in his life. Because, yes, he had a bad childhood, but it's like, I'm sure you have millions of children in the world who have much worse childhoods than him.
Right, who don't become murderers then, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes a man commit evil actions like that? probably something genetic. He has a history of mental illnesses in the family. Then it's definitely the lack of a father. And that's also interesting when you see many of the terrorists, the Islamic terrorists, the foreign fighters going to Syria. That's one unifying factor, a lack of a father. So then it's the instability at home, instable mothers, if we can, you know, talk in headlines here a bit. So she has this love-hate relationship to her son. I love you, I hate you, I wish you were never born, I want to give you away, I want to give you to, you know, foster care. And then in the next moment, she would hug him, they would sleep tied together at night. So definitely that is a bad start. And then there's something about him that makes him not be welcome. In his childhood, he reshapes himself and he remakes himself so many times to try to fit in there, in that gang with
right,
these
he tries to join various groups, and they always end up rejecting him. And eventually, as a young man, then he basically just goes off and spends years playing video games like World of Warcraft and Call of Duty.
Yeah, he tries to find a place to belong. He's rejected because there's something about him that people just don't, you know, they don't want him around. There's something. And then he loses his money because he desperately wants to become rich, because he wants to be admired. He wants to be seen. He wants to be something big. He wants his father, who saw him occasionally every summer holiday. But after he was 15, he never saw him again. He didn't want to see his son. So Anders Breivik was going around telling his friends, if I did something really great, something really big, maybe my father would see me.
One thing that's striking is in some ways how similar Anders Breivik is to the people he detests. I mean, the kinds of people who would go join Al-Qaeda, for instance, who've also committed brutal murders. I mean, it's the outsider who feels rejected by society, who feels isolated, and then looks for a grand cause and has violent fantasies that will bring him glory.
Yeah, and it's true that all extremists resemble. They have the same worldview of dividing us and them, good and bad, this wanting to cleanse, this wanting to purify the world or the caliphate, or in Anders Breivik's case, in his manifesto that he wrote, to purify Europe from all Muslims and all Muslim influence.
You said that the interesting question is when he became evil. I mean, he wasn't born that way. He committed these horrible acts. I mean, arguably the biggest trauma in Norway since the Second World War, since the Nazi occupation.
Yeah. It's probably, even though I posed the question myself, it's probably the wrong question, because he doesn't see himself as evil. He sees himself as doing good. Just as the Islamists in ISIS and in Syria would say, he sees himself as a savior. But when does that start? I think it comes quite late. So slowly he's going onto the even darker sides of the internet, which is the fascist sides, the white supremacist sides and the neo-Nazi sides and anti-immigration, anti-Islamist sides and so on. And he, of course, again, he wants to suck up to the leaders, as he'd done all his life, trying to be a member of a gang. He wants to be a member of this gang. And then in the last moment, he's even rejected here. One of those who he'd contacted said that he hadn't bothered to answer him because, not because he was extreme, but because he was so boring. And so he's rejected even here. That was January of 2010. The next month, in February, that's when he starts to buy the weapons.
Let's talk for just a little bit about July 22nd, 2011, when he killed all these people, 77 people. I mean, first he blew up the government building, hoping to kill the prime minister, killed, what, 8 people there, and then went off to this island where lots of young students were. I mean, he would just walk from one kid to the next, shooting them in the head.
Yeah, he spared no one. And that's when I think this video game mentality comes in. He just shot and left, shot and left, shot and left. Beforehand, he had been calculating how many people he needed to kill to be famous. And to be famous, he wanted to be read, because he wrote that big manifesto and he called the massacre his book launch, because he wanted his manifesto to be read. And he decided that he needed to kill minimum 12 people, and then he ended up killing 77.
What was the hardest part for you in telling the story?
To talk to the parents of these teenagers, because I felt, when I contacted them, I felt that I was intruding into a family, intruding into a grief, and still I knew I had to do it.
Did these families want to talk to you?
Yeah, they did. So how did I choose? Because there's only three main families in the book. They kind of chose themselves. So what happened during the trial, there's a very strong guy whose name is Viljar, who's shot 5 times on the island, first in his thigh, in his shoulder, in his arm, and then last through his eye. The doctors don't understand how it's possible. The brain was lying outside of his skull. And then the policeman who came after the massacre, they think he's dead, so they don't take him. And then some policeman comes up to him and he finds this little pulse of this boy. And the policeman was a former soldier from Afghanistan, so he knew this war injuries. So he put the brain back into the skull and patched it together as you would do with a ceramic bowl or something, got him into this boat, taking him over to the other side. There's a helicopter waiting to take him to the hospital. He's in coma for 10 days. And there's one night when he's getting so cold and the doctor's telling the parents, you know, this is the end. But you have one last chance to give him the will to live. He must want to live. Talk to him, cuddle him, do whatever. And then a friend of his is coming and he's talking about, you know, what they will do when they will get out. And at some point, this friend is starting to sing. And he's singing a song that they, you know, sang together. And early morning that, you know, after a long night, the boy in the bed, Viljar, starts to sing along with his friend. That's the start. And this boy now, he is studying psychology at the university now for the, now it's on his third year. He's blind on one eye. He doesn't have a shoulder. He can't ski any longer. He can't do all those things that he loved to do before. But that boy was testifying in court. And I was thinking, you know, that boy has to be part of the book. And he went to Utøya with his best friends. There were three. He was the only one to come back. So his two best friends are the two other main characters of the book.
Wow, what an amazing story of human resilience.
Yeah, I think it's important in the book that there are, you know, also stories of survival. Yeah, it's dark to get to know Breivik. It's not someone you really would want to get to know. I have to be honest to say, you know, I'm glad that I'm done with him. I'm never going to go back. I don't need to care about it. I'm done with him.
That was Steve Paulson talking with journalist Asna Sejersted. She's the author of One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. And we're going to change the subject now from radical terror to radical peace. And the story of a wandering Buddhist teacher after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Tanya Lerman. I'm an anthropologist at Stanford. And my dangerous idea is that the way that you think about thinking changes your experience of thought. And I think that the way that you pay attention to your inner experience, the way you imagine your mind, changes the way you experience yourself when you're religious, the way you experience yourself when you have psychiatric illness, the way you experience yourself when you're walking down the street. I think Americans think of the mind as a fortress, shut off from the outside world. Nobody can get in. Nothing gets out. Your inner experience is really important to you. Knowing your feelings shapes who you are. Sharing your feelings defines who you are. That's not the way that people in the rest of the world always think about thinking. And I think in consequence, we tend to live in a world in which when we have experiences in which our thoughts seem to pop outside and shout at us, we associate that with psychiatric illness. It's the one defining feature of what it is to be ill. And those experiences harass us and make us feel like they're driving us crazy. When we're religious, it means that the way that you experience God, I think, is often thinner than in other parts of the world, where it feels as if your thoughts are somehow what it is to connect to God, and God acquired this more airy quality than he would if the imagination were less marked as something that you took to be false. I think what you do with that awareness of the mind is become conscious that the way that you're thinking about thinking does shape some of the ways that you react to your own experience of thought, that you could imagine the mind as not somehow this fortress that could be broken, but somehow more engaged with everyday reality. I think what you do is recognize that some of the ways that we think about psychiatric illness depend on an understanding of what it is to think that might be American rather than something that's rooted in the body. When you think about your thoughts as being shaped by your hyper-awareness of thinking, you can judge your own anxieties and inner voices as being less hostile and difficult than you might experience them as being.
Tanya Lerman with her Dangerous Idea. You can also browse our entire collection of Dangerous Ideas online at ttbook.org. Everyone knows the Dalai Lama, but there's a new generation of Tibetan Buddhist leaders just coming of age, and among them, Mingyur Rinpoche. He's a renowned Buddhist lama who runs a network of meditation centers around the world. And Steve Paulson has been hearing stories about him and recently got a chance to talk with him. Steve, who is Mingyur Rinpoche?
He's still quite young, in his early 40s, total baby face, but he's already considered a master contemplative and a reincarnated lama. And I first heard about Mingyur Rinpoche a few years ago when some Buddhists were talking about this guy in India who had just disappeared one day and no one knew where he went. It was kind of a shocking thing to happen in the Buddhist world.
What do you mean he just disappeared?
Someone at his monastery in India knocked on his door and discovered that Rinpoche wasn't there. And they just found a letter that he had left saying that he'd gone away on a wandering retreat. People shouldn't worry about him. They shouldn't come and try to find him. And he would come back when the time was right, but he didn't say when.
Well, clearly he came back since you interviewed him. But how long was he gone?
4.5 years.
Wow.
So he came back in November of 2015, and he had an amazing story to tell, including a near-death experience.
You talked with him in person, right?
Right, yeah.
So what is he like?
So I went to his hotel room when he was in Madison leading a retreat, which he does all around the world. And so in his hotel room, he's in his Buddhist robe, sort of this, you know, small man, very cheerful. He hops up on the chair, sits in a full lotus, sort of never moves, you know, except for as he's talking and sort of gets animated. And he's just, you know, he's someone you want to be in his presence. And I asked him why he had just picked up and left.
So in Tibet, we have some kind of tradition, what we call wandering retreat. So main idea is there's no money and no fixed plan and no support. Just go on street. So based on baking the food, and then just move without plan.
Ever since he was a child, Rinpoche had dreamed of going on one of these wandering retreats. In fact, his father, who was himself a renowned Buddhist teacher, had also wanted to do this, but every time he mentioned it to people in his monastery, they begged him to stay. So Mingye Rinpoche knew he couldn't tell anyone he was leaving.
If I tell them, then they will drag me, you know.
They will say, don't go.
Don't go, please, if you go, then. So a real plan cannot tell. So then I just live one day in the midnight.
So, I mean, just to put this in perspective, I mean, what I heard is that you didn't take your passport, you didn't take any money, you didn't take anything except for the clothes that you were wearing.
Yeah, no passport, nothing. And in the beginning, I have about maybe 1,000 rupees, but then it finished within 3 weeks. So then after that, I have to bake the food. I have no plan, nothing, nowhere to go. And I feel very embarrassed being on, stay on street. I don't mind there's no bed. I don't mind there's no room. But just embarrassed. I feel like everybody's looking at me, just feeling very uncomfortable.
You come from a very well-known family. You were a renowned teacher. This must have been totally new for you. I mean, just to be essentially begging on the street.
Yeah, yes. I'm saying I'm kind of like Dharma prince. So I have nice family and I have nice friends. I never stay on the street even 1 hour. So this is completely different from me. So the first night when I stay on the street, wow, really, really different world. And in the daytime, there are some dogs around there. And we were friends in the daytime. But nighttime, they're all barking and chasing after me because I have to use, you know, restroom. There's no restroom in particular, you know, in the street, right?
So you would go day to day. Sometimes you didn't know where your food was coming from. I would think you must have gotten very nervous at times. I mean, you know, would you find food? And then during all this time, of course, you're also, you're meditating. I mean, you're trying to maintain that peaceful state of mind, and yet your body must be fighting against that at times. And your body is sort of, you know, telling you, I need food.
Yeah, so I try to meditate. And then after some times, I have just trust, some belief, kind of like, okay, nothing happened today, and something happened tomorrow, and I can get food. Yes.
You always had this belief that you would find food, that you were not going to starve.
Not the beginning, of course.
When friends of Mingye Rinpoche heard that he'd left his monastery, they worried that his childhood anxieties might resurface. When he was little, he had crippling panic attacks, so severe he'd break out in a cold sweat when he was around people he didn't know. Thunder and snowstorms terrified him. And when he was 13, he started a 3-year retreat, which actually made the panic worse at the beginning. He'd get dizzy and feel waves of panic during his group prayers.
I was born in Nepal, right in the middle of the Himalayan mountains, very nice environment, but I had panic. And I learned meditation from my father when I was 9 years old. But then I'm lazy. So when I was young, I'm lazy boy. I lied.
That's not what I've heard. I've heard you were a prodigy when it came to meditation.
Not really. I mean, my panic get worse. Then I thought, okay, I'm going to accept my panic. Until then, I tried to get rid of my panic by meditation. So I thought, I'm going to accept. Once panic become my friend, panic's gone.
Explain that. What does it mean to make friends with your panic?
Yeah. Sometime when I was young, I don't like the panic. So what I call panic of the panic. So try to get rid of a panic, panic become your enemy. So then when I accept, I just face my panic and use my panic as support for 3 things. Awareness, love and compassion, and wisdom. So wisdom within the panic. So therefore, we can make friends with the panic.
And you said that by the time you had gone on this wandering retreat, I mean, obviously years later, you no longer had any experience of panic.
Panic didn't come back.
Mingye Rinpoche went on to become a renowned Buddhist teacher in his own right. He started a monastic college in northern India and founded the Tergar community, a worldwide network of meditation groups. He was even formally recognized as the incarnation of the 17th century Tibetan master Yonge Mingye Rinpoche. But still, he was hardly prepared for what happened just a few weeks into his wandering retreat.
I got kind of like food poison or virus because in India, the street food is not so clean. And then I almost died.
What happened when you almost died?
What happened is I have diarrhea. vomiting and diarrhea and for 3 days. And on the fourth day, I cannot move. And I thought I'm going to die. But then for 2 hours, I'm very nervous. What should I do? If I want to go back, one phone call will be okay. So they will come and I can go back. So should I go back or should I continue to stay? And I made a decision to stay.
Did you make a decision to die?
Yeah, kind of like that. Suicide mission. But anyway, I just let it go, let it be. Whatever happens, happens. Then after that, I feel quite okay and happy. There's a particular meditation that kind of 4 steps. First, letting go. And second, then kind of like what we call dedication. Whatever you did in your life, you just appreciate, gratitude, thank you. And third is the motivation, boost motivation. So this is the journey also. And you can learn until the last minute breath. So the death is the adventure, the best adventure in our life. And then pray. Then after that, what we call rest our mind into open awareness. So I cannot see, I cannot hear. Then my body become paralyzed. Then there's a lot of, how to say, happening, like falling and floating and like so many experiences. So I just rest into open awareness, just being, the sense of presence. Then I thought, now I'm really going to die. But my mind is so clear. Suddenly, completely open my mind. Like blue sky without cloud and sun shining.
Do you think you had lost consciousness? I mean, were you in some other state of consciousness at that point?
There's no time. Normally what I call monkey mind, you know, bala bala bala, yada yada yada. This monkey mind is gone. But at the same time, I know, but knowing without thinking. And that experience is so precious, so blissful, so joyful. And I stayed there within that state somehow. Maybe 4-5 hours until morning, sun is coming. I know sun is coming also. Although my eyes are closed, I cannot hear. Then somehow I feel like this is not the time to me to die, some kind of feeling.
Was this what we in the West would call a near-death experience?
I don't know. It's not the out-of-body experience. Out-of-body experience means you kind of soul coming out of your body and you look up there and your body, not like that. But it's not inside, not outside. There's no sense of body, but mind completely open and beyond.
Because a lot of, from many people's stories of their near-death experiences, I mean, there are some common elements. I mean, there's right. The white light, the tunnel, sometimes visions of angelic beings, sometimes right. dead people who somehow come back into their visions. Did you have any of that?
No, those visions. Just sense of this awareness, pure awareness, and there's no conceptual mind. And there's no time and no direction front and back.
After that experience, anybody else might have retreated back to the safety of the monastery. But Rinpoche decided his journey was just beginning, so he headed even further away from civilization.
Summer, I go into the Himalaya Mountains. Mostly, I went to Nepal, just borderline between Tibet and Nepal. So there's a lot of holy places. So there's Cave of Milarepa, so many nice caves, and stay there.
Wait, so you would just stay in a cave? How big a cave?
Some caves are very big, some caves not so big. Some caves have the window and door, some there's no window and door. But most of the cave inside dry during rainy season. I have to get there before the monsoon season. So I can collect all the woods and I can collect dry tree leaves, dry grass. So I can make nice bed, you know, mattress. And nearby there sometimes I can get wild vegetables, wild mushrooms, quite nice.
What is it like to live in a cave for weeks or even months at a time?
Stay in the cave, so nice for me. After I have this almost die experience, everything's okay. I can stay everywhere and very happy to be alive.
So that changed you. I mean, that experience, nearly dying. I mean, you were a different person at that point?
After that, I'm become a different person. Before that, although I been meditating for a long time, but still there's what we call grasping, cannot let go. Then after that, I'm so happy that so much gratitude, so much appreciation, just having these wonderful eyes to can see many things, just being, just seeing, just hearing, just experiencing.
Rinpoche lived that way for 4.5 years. In the winters, he came down from the mountains into India and became a sadhu, a Hindu yogi who begs and lives on the street. But eventually, he decided it was time to go home, back to his monastery. And today he travels all over the world teaching Dharma and some of those lessons he learned from his years living on the street.
Yes, so now many people, they can meditate very easy on the cushion, but then off cushion, like, please, quiet, I'm meditating, you know. So cannot deal the problem in day-to-day life. So I'm more focused about meditation, how to apply in daily life.
What does that mean? I mean, let's say for Americans who spend their work days in an office, do you have any advice for them?
Yes. You can meditate everywhere, anytime. So you can meditate at office, going to exercise, only 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds. Okay, you don't need to have a special cushion. You don't need to have perfect posture for meditation. So open awareness, just being, resting your mind and body, just being with the present moment. Awareness is always present. So you can do that while you're drinking coffee, you're having a meeting.
Wait, but you're saying you can have a 2-second meditation, a 4-second meditation, that can actually be meaningful?
Of course, of course. Even 2 seconds, it changes day.
You're inspiring me here. But I think there are years and years of practice that goes into what you're talking about.
It takes time, not so easy, but even 2 seconds, 1 minute in the morning helps all day.
That's Mingyur Rinpoche talking with Steve Paulson. Rinpoche is the founder and guiding teacher of the Turgar community, which has meditation centers all over the world. He returned from his 4-year wandering retreat in 2015. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes or Stitcher or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. And if you want to comment on anything you heard this hour, we'd love to hear from you. Share your thoughts with us on our Facebook page or send us email at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our producers include Doug Gordon, Mark Rickers, Charles Monroe Kane, and Raymond Tungekar. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.